You're listening to the Road to Black Tech Week, where culture, capital, and creativity collide. In this episode, we take you inside a powerful fireside chat with Dilali Jarafa, founder and CEO of Fearless, a purpose-driven software company scaling impact across federal agencies, civic tech, and beyond. In this conversation, moderated by Brian Brakeen, we follow Dilali's incredible journey, bootstrapping from his mother's basement to leading a multi-million dollar enterprise with nearly 500 employees. If you're a founder scaling with heart, a leader building culture first, or just curious on how to turn values into velocity, this one's for you. And don't forget, Black Tech Week 2025 returns July 14th through the 16th in Cincinnati. Get your pass at blacktechweek.com. Let's jump in.
All right. Black Tech Week, you look good today. Thank you, brother.
Thank you for doing this. Wouldn't have missed it.
Man, I would have came and got you and pulled you up here if I had to.
I appreciate it, man. Happy to be here.
So we'll start at the top. One, good morning.
Good morning as well.
Good morning to you.
Good morning, good people.
Why did you come join us here at Black Tech Week?
Yeah, so Black Tech Week is interesting. So number one, I'm black. Number two, I'm in tech. So I feel like I kind of need to be at Black Tech Week. But really, it's an opportunity not just to share, but more importantly, to learn. So I've been sitting here taking notes, making sure that I'm gleaning from people that are here, building connections, networking, and really trying to grow my social capital, as well as make connections and figure out how we can get to the next level.
Who are you?
That's a deep question. Who am I? So I am a son of immigrants from Ghana. I'm a father. I've got two boys. I'm a husband. I'm a lover of technology. I'll tell you a little bit about Fearless and the business that I run. So Fearless, we are a tech for good firm. And when we think about technology, we really believe that technology ought to be used to improve people's lives. And our mission, as we describe it, is building software with the soul, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later. And our vision really is to create a world where good software and good technology powers the things that actually matter. And we're going to talk about a lot. We've been talking a lot about technology this week. There's amazing tech in your phones and in our cars, and cars are driving themselves, and people are going into space and all sorts of great stuff. But when we think about technology that typically does not power things like education, does not power effectively things like healthcare, things like social justice, we've kind of built a business around that to ensuring that we're helping to make the world just a little bit better, one piece at a time. Fearless is probably most famous for a bit of our work we've done with the federal government, including the Small Business Administration. So we've powered their digital face for years. And in the height of the pandemic, which is one of the highlights of my career, we had Congress passes the PPP program, and everyone's scrambling, everyone's kind of scared, trying to figure out what's going on. And we had 10 days notice where we had to build a new web portal that allowed small businesses across the country to process and get their PPP loans. And so if you were a recipient of PPP check, you're welcome. We built that tech on the back end. The team worked a lot of hours to get that done. So shout out to the whole SBA team at Fearless. We've also supported a couple of interesting projects. Search.gov is one of our properties. And so we are the federal government search engine across a couple thousand search boxes. So think of us as Google for government from a federal, state, and local perspective. We are the company that was awarded a national competition to support the Smithsonian in the National Museum of African American History and Culture. So we took their slavery and freedom exhibit online post George Floyd, and in a world where everyone was thinking about and everyone was talking about racial justice conversations. There's lots of tension in the space, and to be able to tell our story to the world was amazing. And so that team was able to deliver not just that exhibit, which was a complete first for the Smithsonian online, but went on to create four more virtual exhibits for them as well. We were a Webby honoree for that, one of the top three sites in its category in the world, and 140 countries accessing that property within 6 months. So it's been a bit of a whirlwind for us as an organization. And lastly, we founded an incubator called Hutch.
Yeah.
to support and really get more women and more minorities in the tech services space specifically. And so we've got about 28 companies in that portfolio today. And then we've got some commercial stuff with the NFL we'll talk about a little bit later. But it's been quite a cool journey.
This Fearless company sounds pretty big. Like, how many people are you? Tell me more about that. Where are you based?
Yeah, so we're based out of, headquartered out of Baltimore, Maryland. So
holla!
I got Baltimore folks in the house. So Corey told me we should change the title to Bootstrapped a Billion in Baltimore. So I'm going to shout out to Baltimore.
Sounds
Corey,
like
let
him.
Me know if I did that right. So total number of jobs that we support, so a little under 500, so about 450, 460 jobs total. So we're the largest software developer in the region. We're the largest Black-owned business in the region as well. And so we've been at it for 14 years. We'll be 15 in February.
And you, as I understand it, your parents are billionaires. They gave you all this money to start the company.
Right.
Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So I had many golden spoons in my mouth, diamond spoons as well. But no, my mom and dad came to the States. So I was born in D.C., really in search for, you know, better opportunities for us and for their kids. So born here and had to hustle. Had to hustle as a kid. I'm the youngest of three. My parents divorced when I was fairly young. And, you know, we couldn't afford to get, you know, all the nice shoes and couldn't go to movies and couldn't do all the things that our friends were doing. And so my mom said, you got to work for it. You got to figure it out. So at an early stage, we knocked door to door and we did everything. You know, you talk about, you know, car washes and cutting grass and walking dogs and paper routes and painting and all the other stuff. So I don't hate manual labor. I just will never do it again. I've done more than my fair share of cutting grass. So, but I learned that hustle kind of as a kid, right? And at some point, you knock on enough doors, somebody's going to say yes, and I'm going to make $10. And that, I think that's really what spurred like the entrepreneurial spirit in me as a kid.
And it seems like it's reflected in the work you do now. So you're a co-founder of Baltimore Young Professionals, right? You do a lot of work. You talked about Hutch and the work there. What is the thread that connects how you grew up to the sense of service that you have now?
I think a couple things, and I didn't know that this was the case until I was much older. But my dad is a computer scientist, so I grew up around computers. I was fortunate enough to, you know, we had a computer at his house growing up, so we all learned how to program as kids. Mm-hmm. So that part I always thought was really interesting. My mom, was a nurse. A retired nurse now, and so this sense of empathy and service, and we have spent more time than I'd care to admit in nursing homes and hospitals. And you know, I hated that stuff as a kid, right? It's like, I want to go outside, like, let's go to the hospital. I'm like, for what? and really building this sense of service and caring for your fellow man became incredibly important. And so you fast forward now, it's almost like a perfect blend of both of them, this ability to create and bring software and be creative in that space that serves people is really, I think, is a direct tie to, both of their influences in my life.
And my father taught me how to code when I was 8 years old. Mm-hmm. And so teaching your kids about technology, how to code, it pays off in ways that aren't always about code.
Like, that's right.
I don't know if they still let you code the job. They don't let me code here, mine.
They kicked me out a long time ago. Yeah. I start stepping in the code. They start locking my access out.
Yes. Like,
go sit in the corner, sir.
No leader actually runs their company, as we both know. But it's really important for the crowd. Looks like one of your first contracts with the Secret Service. Mm-hmm. Curious about how that came to be and what secrets can you share with us?
Absolutely. You're trying to get me sniped out here. I will not die today, sir. But, you know, so coming out of college, I worked for a defense contractor. And, you know, we had a number of projects kind of through that space in the Department of Homeland Security. Secret Service was one of my customers. Well, I'd built some software for them. I was a front-end developer. And I remember working on a project. I was, I think, one or two front-end developers on a project that I supported them with. And we did really well. We delivered that project probably a couple months early. And so started to build a bit of a name for myself within that customer space. And so when I jumped out and started Fearless, went back and let the customer know. And they gave us a shot on a really small, prime contract. you know, at that point, building some technology. And so what people, most people think about Secret Service, they think about, you know, the folks with the, you know, the earpiece and the, all right, Eagles on the move and, you know, and they're all of that. And that is one of their two missions. The other part, which most folks don't really realize that Secret Service is also responsible for, is they're actually the agency that is responsible for ensuring the financial integrity of the integrity of the financial system here in America. Mm-hmm. It's actually not FBI. And so when you think about mortgage fraud cases and things like that, Secret Service is actually the one that investigates them. So we supported the financial side of the Secret Service. And so building tech in that space, and it became really important because if you think about, you know, whether it be fraud or any sort of other financial crimes, all of those things make restrictions and policies tougher for everyone else who's not committing crimes, right, in order to get stuff done. So supporting in that world was really important for us to be able to get started.
So speaking about those kind of early beginnings, you started in your mother's basement. Mm-hmm. Is this the case?
Yep.
And I've been to your new space now. Absolutely stunning. Maybe take people through how space has really manifested over time too.
Yeah. So Fearless started in my basement, $6,000 and a dream and a hope and a wish. And, you know, realized pretty early that, you know, I tell you, I want up all the stories of the founders starting in the basements. We couldn't even afford to do that. We got to move out. And it really was, how do we make sure that we give the business the best chance of success? So thought was, well, how do we cut our expenses? The biggest expense at that point was the home. It was the mortgage. And so said, all right, well, we're going to either sell the house or rent the house and sell all our stuff and go move in the basement, which sounded like a completely great idea. So I'm in the house. I'm packing. I'm excited. And my wife's like, what are you packing for? And I'm like, oh, we're moving to my mom's house. She's like, we're doing what?
That's the first you heard.
Yeah. So I forgot to tell her that that we were gonna move, and so I took a couple steps back. So first lesson.
And you're still married too.
Yeah, okay. Surprisingly. Okay. So first lesson to all the founders is you should talk to your family and make sure everybody is on the same page first. But she graciously agreed, and I had a young son at the time, and she said, "I'm here." She's riding for me. Said, "But you don't have forever," and gave me a year, and said, "We're gonna do this for a year." So. Ended up cutting our expenses, you know, renting the house out. We put some stuff in storage, sold the rest of our stuff, and the journey really started. Cut my salary, and we pumped everything. We pumped everything in the business, and this idea of partnership was formed early on. I tell all the time, like she bootstrapped us, right? She's the one that she had a job supporting us. My wife is a physician, and prior to that, she had been in residency for a few years, and they work a million hours a week, right? Yeah. She's a pediatrician. And so I had the stable job and the stable 9-to-5. And so we waited for her to finish, and then we swapped. I was like, all right, my turn, right? And so she had the stable job and really made sure that we were okay to give the business a chance to get off the ground. And it's not fun moving back to your parents' house because they still try to act like your parent. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, Mom, I'm grown. I got a whole family. She's like, yeah, but you're in my house.
Yeah.
So now you're back to my rules. So that was awesome. So needless to say, I had 12 months and did it in 10. We moved out in 10 months. Nice. Fearless was born.
Has some motivation too, though.
That is motivation. Got two women mad at me. Gotta get out of here.
I have a follow-up question, not on the cards, but you know, immigrant parents, black parents in general, sometimes are not used to these like tech and innovation jobs. So when the kid says, I'm not going to be a doctor, I'm not going to be a lawyer, I want to do this, you know, tech thing in your basement, how did that go?
She's like, you're doing what? Right? And it feels like it's a hobby until you tell them you're quitting your job to do it.
Yep.
And, you know, when it was the hobby, it was kind of cool. You know, oh, you're doing some computer stuff on the side of your job, right? Mm-hmm. And that's okay. And I think she was concerned, right? She was concerned, you know, we didn't come here for you to go start chasing stuff, get a stable job. And the bigger names are important, right? And why don't you go work for this company or that company that I've heard of, right? And listing all of the other things that I could and should be doing. But ultimately, was supportive. I think everyone in the family was pretty supportive. They knew I was serious about it, mm-hmm. and they saw the work that I was putting in. So everyone, they've been along for the journey everywhere along the way to, you know, we had some early events and watching some of the kids in the company while we, you know, did the company events and being plugged in. And my mom was like, where's my fearless hoodie? Right. I want a fearless hoodie. And so now being super excited, but I think they're ultimately pretty, pretty proud.
I own a fearless pin. I'm very proud of it.
Thank I love you. It. We got you some more swag. We got you some more stuff, but yeah.
Yeah.
Love it. Love it.
All the merch.
That's
all
right.
Bootstrapping. Let's talk a little bit about that. Why did you do it that way? In a world where this person raised this much and that person raised that much, right? It seems like we're always inundated with these stories. And that sometimes is, and I say this as a venture capitalist, so this isn't good for me, but like it's sometimes that's seen as success, right? But it doesn't necessarily mean that that's at right. all. So why did you choose this route? I'll leave it at that.
I don't know if I chose this route. I didn't know
it chose you.
Other routes. It chose me. You know, when I was starting, I didn't know people were out there raising capital and you needed money to start a business. I had a dream and I was just going to go do the thing, right? And so you always often hear, you know, ignorance is bliss, right? And so I didn't know the stats of, you know, less than 2% of Black founders get money and you can't start your business and all of those other things. And don't get me wrong, I think that it's incredibly important to understand like the dynamics of what are happening kind of in the space at the moment, right? And there are challenges, right? There are many, many, many challenges, right? And barriers to success for all of us as business, especially Black-owned businesses and women-owned businesses within our market. But I didn't know any better, right? And I think sometimes it really comes to, you know, I know you think everyone is against you and the system is trying to push you down, but it might could also be that your pies aren't that good, Keisha. Right?
Keisha catching a stray.
It might be, I don't mean to pick on Keisha, and Keisha's in the audience. I'd like to apologize now.
Jill.
Jill. We'll use Jill.
Karen. Karen's pies are terrible.
But like when you're in a space and you don't know that you need capital to run the business, right? At that point, you do whatever it takes to be successful, right? And when you're starting a new venture, it requires all of you, right? A startup is something that you think about every day, every night, weekends, over lunch, whatever you're talking about. Like, this is the baby, this is the dream, right? There isn't, I'm gonna do this 50%, 20%. You gotta be 100% in all the time, or there isn't a likelihood of success, right? And even if you do that, you still might not make it. And so with it requiring absolutely everything of you, you can spend all day complaining about the lack of capital and the lack of resources and the lack of everything else, or you can spend time chasing the dream, right? And so in that early space, again, I didn't know any better. And so bootstrapping, it wasn't like I'm picking bootstrapping. It's like, I'm starting the business. What do I need to do? Right? What do I need to learn? Who do I need to know? And so in those moments, I chose to focus on the customer. Focus on the customer. What am I building? What is my value prop that is going to be significant enough that someone wants to buy from me and not from somebody else? Yeah. And so when you start to do that, right, it changes your mindset about like, I'm going to go get this thing done. Now, don't get me wrong. There are some fundamental things you can do as you're bootstrapping the business, right? And so the first thing I mentioned when I talked about moving home, you can create capital and create margin. And I talk to founders all the time. There's one guy I was talking about, and he was so excited about it. I'm starting a business. I said, great. What are you going to put together and how are you going to do it? And you may need it. And he was a consulting business. I said, all right, so show us the pipeline and what are you looking at? And he said, yeah, but I don't want to do any of those things. Mm-hmm. Cool. All right, cool. Cut some expenses. Can you like, you know, cut some out of the house? No, I don't want to move. Now I got to make a little bit more. And I don't want to do that. And all these things in which he wasn't going to do. Mm-hmm. I'm like, good luck. And so there's practical things you can do to how do I limit my expenses in order to put some more money and resources within the business? How do you barter? Bartering is a huge way in which you can bootstrap for the organization. We did that early on. We've got a really close partner company named Clarity. And when we started around the same time. And I remember starting off, it was very complimentary services. And we were trying to chase a couple proposals. And we didn't have a proposal writer. And we were misspelling words and typos and all sorts of crazy stuff. But they did. And I said, hey, man, can we borrow your writer? We need some help. And said, all right, we'll do that. We'll do it at cost. And they let her work on all our proposals. and that was helpful. And they were trying to get their brand together, a lot of their graphics together. And we had a really dope brand person. They said, well, can we use your person? Yeah, we can use our person, right? And so we started sharing resources. They were great product owners, and we were great on as far from a development team, right? And so we would partner on all of our early projects, and we bid everything together, mm-hmm. right? And so from a bootstrap perspective, we were able to leverage resources that they had, they leveraged resources we have, and they're killing it right now, right? But we grew up together. And so there are extremely practical ways in which you can do that. Starting off, getting customer feedback is a great way in bootstrap. You can get money too early, and you're starting to accelerate something that you haven't proven yet. And that's a quick way to fail and owe some people some money, right? And hurt some feelings in the process. And so spend the time really trying to hone your value proposition, getting your product and your service in front of people, saying, what do you think? Now, Keisha, we say, Jill, ask them, are your pies good? You know, do I need to change the recipe a little bit? And make sure you actually have something worth investing in before you try to go that route.
Jill's gonna get there.
I believe in Jill.
Last question before we turn it over to the audience. If you have questions, there's a mic up here in the front. We would love to hear from you. These are best that when they're that way. So we've talked a lot about your kind of public sector work, right? Mm-hmm. But now you're starting to do some private sector work. So could you tell us about that, maybe with the NFL, others?
Yeah, so I guess it was last year, we announced a deal with Ice Cube in a contract.
All right.
Contract with Black America in the league. And it was an interesting experience. We actually got connected through our work with the Small Business Administration. So post George Floyd, the whole country is thinking about what can we do better? And Ice Cube comes out with a Contract with Black America initiative, which really just says corporate America, do better, right? And so they're talking with the league, and he's meeting with the commissioner and says, you know, some of what the league can do better is shift some of the existing spend that you have, shifted some Black-owned businesses. And so the league gets excited about that, and they start moving down that path. And so they're going through, you know, all right, who can help us with financial services, and who can help us with the marketing, and who can help us with X, Y, and Z, and they get to tech. Said, who can help us with tech? So I don't know, call Ice Cube. And they said, Cube, who can help us with tech? And I'll call us, and we had a fully close relationship with the former leadership of the Small Business Administration. They said, call them. And they said, call Fearless. So we got vetted, you know, 18,000 times on the way over. And when it got time to really talk about the deal that we were going to do with them, our team actually at Fearless was relatively split on if we take it or not. And the main reason being, you know, around that time, there was plenty in the news around, you know, a lot of the clubs around the NFL that are super toxic for women mm-hmm. in work environments. Mm-hmm. And you hear story after story of minority coaches, women not getting GM positions and coaching positions. And they were kind of like, do we want to be affiliated with that? Mm. And so as we met and worked with a little of the team internally and got to know them and their story, we realized there are a ton of amazing people there that are trying to also shift this culture. So we said, if you're looking for a tech company just to build products in here, we're not the right shop. But if we can be a part of helping to shift the culture that we see that they're trying to shift, then we're down. And they agreed. So we were the only tech company named as a part of that partnership. Their press release came out. And you know, one of the first products that we're working on is, think of it is LinkedIn meets a highlight reel for women and other diverse candidates. And so when various clubs call the NFL and say, hey, we got a coaching position, instead of going to the same network they go to every single time, it's like, well, here are 50 women and minorities that can do that job, and they get with our whole highlight reel. Mm. And so now you start to think about the shift that makes within the league. And so we're beyond proud, and Cube and their whole team, they've been great partners in this. The NFL, their whole DI office, they've been just great partners, and everyone that we work there so far. And so we're super proud about that work.
Follow up. Okay, clap. I love the clap. I love it. Quick follow up as people make their way to the mic. I see you guys rushing over. Just slowly, please, slowly. Public or private? What are the kind of benefits?
Yeah. Challenges? I actually don't think they're that different. And I'll use the NFL for example, right? So you have kind of the league level. I think there's more difference between like big and small organizations. Mm-hmm. From the NFL perspective, you've got the league level that's got, you know, obviously a lot of, you know, direction and guidance, right, for the league policies that happen at that level. But as far as the various clubs, there's lots of independence that happens, right? There's flexibility that can be done, and they're their own organizations. It's not very dissimilar to federal and states. Mm-hmm. And so that same tension that we see from federal policies or federal guidance or resources that come down to states, and states have some independence in what they do, it's quite similar to what we see within the NFL. But with any organization, I'd say large, whether public or private, there's always going to be fiefdoms. There's always going to be the camp of this is the way things have always been. The people that are comfortable in that world, and they don't want things to change. And then you're always going to have the innovation, the innovators camp, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we got to change everything. Let's redo all the stuff, right? And there's balance in between. And so we see a lot of similarities. I think the biggest difference becomes typically in the procurement chains. Mm. So, with a private organization, right? You can meet somebody today, right, on the private side, and you could be doing the deal. You can jot some notes on a sheet of paper, shake on a hand, you're making a deal. You do that within the government, somebody's ending up in a jumpsuit. Point blank. We're talking about public taxpayer money, and so there's lots of processes, lots of policies. There's a very structured program in which they buy, in which they procure, and you can't go out of those channels. And so we see that is one of the major differences. And again, smaller organizations, I think, can move a little faster, but you're talking about large public, private organizations as well. They've got same amount of bureaucracy and rigor that you get in, but some of the procurement is a little bit different.
I'd like to make this more about me for a second. I'm kidding. But I forgot to say, hi, I'm Brian Breckin, general partner of Lightship Capital. We're a $50 billion venture fund. Focus on women and minority founders, and you're your host here at Black Tech Week. We love having you guys here.
Shout out to our hosts.
Thank you. But I said that to bring it back to you and back to Baltimore. We work in cities oftentimes that have immense opportunity, but have been overlooked by investment, right? And I believe strongly that the opportunity in Baltimore is limitless, absolutely limitless. So tell us a little more about Baltimore, what you love about it, what the opportunity is.
I could talk all day about the opportunities that exist in Baltimore, but majority, minority, which makes no sense to me, but it's a black city, right? And in that space, within the technology space in general, right, we look at opportunity, and opportunities aren't readily available. There are huge amounts of disparities that exist within Baltimore. Baltimore is one of those cities that the zip code that you are born in can determine as much of a 20-year life expectancy difference. 20 years based on your zip code. And you think about kids that are born into this environment, right? And a lot of times the hopelessness that might exist in a city like that, but Baltimore is also quite rich with opportunities, right? Our governor, Wes Moore, talks about this very often, that we are very much so asset rich, but strategy poor. Within our state. And so being able to connect a lot of the assets that exist, right? Some of the top hospitals in the world, Hopkins, right? That in Maryland, and what's happening there. There is a really interesting intersection of a bunch of technology that exists within Baltimore that is kind of germane to our country in general. So you think, and I'll just start from the public perspective, and I'll talk about some private as well. So it's the home of the National Security Agency, right? I'm talking within a 30, 40 mile radius, right? Home of the National Security Agency, Cyber Command, Defense Information Security Agency. And so we think about securing our entire country. That happens in our region. You think about Social Security, right? And all the benefits that we look forward to and our families look forward to. All that happens out of Baltimore. The largest public insure in the world, with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid 20 minutes outside of us in Baltimore. So all of that technology exists, and it's powered there. It is pretty much the intersection of the midpoint of Fort Meade, Aberdeen Proving Grounds, where the Army and Army Research Lab exists. And so you have a big defense tech apparatus, you've got a public apparatus, you've got a healthcare IT confluence that is happening there within the city. And I talked about the hospitals and the institutions that exists there as well. And so change happens there, right? People often think about Baltimore as, oh, why would I ever go there? And, how we like to reframe it is, that is where you can go to do your best work, right? This is where you can change the world. Mm. There are so many things that are powered from this community, And Corey, I know he's in here as well, really driving a lot of change with an organization called Upsurge. Mm-hmm. And they've really done a really good job of branding the city as the first Equitech. Mm-hmm. Equitech city
say
in the
again.
World.
Say it again.
Equitech city in the world. So you think about opportunities and really paying attention to equity and unrepresented founders, and also building technology that powers those worlds and powers the DEI initiatives and people ops organizations. That's happening in Baltimore.
That's right.
You know, Adam's here too, Techstars, right? And what they're doing, and so many just great things. And again, the pieces have been there. The puzzle is starting to get connected in a way that really hasn't before. And so you think about opportunity, you think about cost of living, you think about the proximity to DC, to New York, to Philly, and how you can get to
Stand
all of
up,
them within
Philly.
A couple hours, Philly in the house.
Go so, Birch.
And so it is a pretty magical destination, right? And I think people that aren't paying attention, right, that see kind of the gentrification that happens, that we've seen south of us in DC, that we've seen happen in New York, there's an opportunity. It's one of the last kind of cities on the East Coast, right? Water facing as well, that hasn't gone through that yet. And it's happening today, right? The narrative outside is the wire. We that live there go outside, walk outside. I mean, there's skyscrapers everywhere. So they're telling a story while they're buying up the city.
Yes.
So don't sleep. There's stuff happening.
I've got some questions here on the right.
Good morning, Winston Peters, educator in higher ed in New York City. Thank you both for this talk. With bootstrapping your business, there's working in the business and working on the business. What were your growing pains from working in the business to going through working on the business?
Right?
Yeah.
That's good.
I love that question. It's a hard shift for many people because you start to feel like you have to do everything, right? So there's a fundamental shift that happens, right? And again, I'm gonna pick on pies, right? Because we've been talking about Jill all day. I'm gonna leave Keisha alone. But you make dope pies, and so someone says you gotta start a bakery, right, to make some pies, right? So you start a bakery, and you wake up one day, and you gotta go unlock the place, and you gotta prep all the stuff, and you gotta make sure the cash register is good, and you gotta unlock, and you're doing customer service, and you're serving, and you're sweeping, and all those other stuff. You're doing the accounting, you're doing the invoicing, all the payroll, and you realize that you're doing everything but making pies. Mm. And I think the shift happens when you realize when you're running a business, it's no longer about making pies. It's about creating a system in which the best pies can be made. And so from a fearless perspective, for the first couple of years, I was a developer and I'm writing software and I'm writing code and I'm sending invoices and I'm billing for my projects and we're making money that way. And there's a shift happens when I said, all right, well, I'm going to stop writing software. I'm going to focus on the business. And it really was creating systems, right? Systems in the business and really trusting that y'all got to take care of the software. I'm going to make sure that your benefits are good and the culture is good. And what is so unique, and especially for our business, we're a services business, right? So you can come to us and we can build you an application, but you can go n number of places and get the same application built. So what is it that makes us so special that someone would want to come here and stay here and do their best work here? And so that's the stuff that you focus on. You focus on the pieces. For us, it was around how do we create belonging where people can feel like I can be myself at work. I can show up authentically in this space. I don't have to worry about how I look or how I dress. That doesn't matter. How can I show up in a place where it's not just about the bottom line, but about impact and being able to tell that story? And so those are the things that I focused on, and that started to attract the tribe that we needed to build the business. But that shift is really, it's really difficult for a lot of people that it isn't about what you can sell, right? It's about what the business can do. And so why I encourage founders all the time is stop saying I. It's always we. I don't care if you're one person. We sell this. We do this. We grew 300%. What's your revenue? $3. We're a dollar last year, though. We're growing, right? Talk big. Talk big. If you don't, no one else will.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Lawrence Kane Jr., born and raised here in Cincinnati, Ohio. I have two companies, Abundance University, which is financial literacy, and then I have a company called Invest in Black Women, where we have merch and we do programming for Black women-owned businesses. My question is specifically around, as we onboard people, how did you go about creating your standard operating procedures? Because I think that's one of my hiccups. As I'm looking to expand, I'm getting a lot of, you know, interest, and we have programming going on in three different school districts. But as I, you know, try to bring on people, it's like, how do I create the right standard operating procedures so that I can delegate the things that I know I need to, so I can be great at the things that I'm great at?
Yeah. I think when you're starting off, there's the temptation where it's got to be perfect. I got to get recruiting perfect before I move on. But the reality is of a startup is you got to move fast. And so you have to understand and have to learn how to balance pace and perfection, right? And so when you look at the table, there's a table right here, right? Imagine you got four different legs on it. If you go and you build one leg, your recruiting leg, right? Or the table's going to be lopsided, it's not going to go. So the way you think about it is if it was the table standing up on bricks, just like one brick, it can be small, but something. And then you got to go look at, all right, how do we look at delivery? All right, how do we do BD? And lay another brick. And then you come back to recruiting one, and you're gonna add a second brick, right? And then you're gonna build them kind of one brick at a time. And over time, what happens is the table starts to get in position. But you can't be perfect. You gotta be quick. You gotta be good enough. Like sometimes starting off, you just gotta be good enough and keep moving, because you can go so perfect in one and your business is not gonna make it. And so I would encourage you to just start small, right? And so you got documents for your standard operating procedures. Let's say you got four things you're working on. Maybe I only got two bullets right now, and I'm gonna train people on the two bullets. I'm gonna get to you next month and just work on those. And you're gonna come back, you're gonna add one, put some stuff on the backlog, come back, add a third bullet. And over time, you fast forward 5 years, 10 years, all right, you got the whole thing fleshed out. Because in reality, it really doesn't matter. You can create the procedures as best as you think today. They're going to change in 2 years anyway. Right. And so it's more important to be flexible and to be nimble and set the process of how we're going to change and how we're going to think about iterating these things like as we go. So good enough is enough. You balance the pace with the perfection.
Thank you.
Hey, good morning. My name is Ron Aribo. I'm the founder and CEO of Champion 6 Solutions. First of all, I want to say shout out to Brian. I graduated from his boot camp about 3 weeks ago, and he told me that you're the number one person I need to talk to. So basically,
now everybody's mad at me because I said that. Why am I not number one?
I had about 20 people say that about other founders. So Brian's
hey, he's pimping you out. So, basically, I want to know that. So I'm a managed IT and staffing firm, and basically, right now my biggest clients are like doctor offices and law firms. But he said, as a veteran-owned company, I need to focus on service contracts with the government. But it seems like the government is really lazy. They want to just work with people that they know. And so it's hard to get into that space. Every morning, wake up, send out my capability statement, nothing. So what? I know you had that relationship prior by working for them, but how do you build that initial relationship?
Yeah. The government and the public sector world is an interesting beast. It is absolutely relationship driven. And you've got to have the domain. I think the first thing you think about, and this is really with any business, is you got to have some sort of value proposition, right? So many people believe that I'm a taxpayer, so you should give me a $1 million contract. And it just doesn't work that way. There is a human and a person on the other end of it that has been tasked, sometimes by law, to get this capability fielded for the American people. And so you've got to be able to make sure that you can deliver. Now, that being said, right, if there's vendors that they've worked with before, they trust, you've got to build in that network. And so for many people, starting off as a subcontractor becomes a viable alternative. That's still within the government contracting landscape. And so you might not work with the VA directly, or you may not work with DOD directly, but there's companies that can, that are, and you can partner with them to be able to provide your capability. The way many of these contracts are structured are there's a statement of work, or statement of objectives that may have, you know, 10 bullets. All right, so you got to, you know, run the help desk, and we need you to build our web applications, and we need to take care of our database, and you got to make sure you're provisioning our cloud, et cetera, right? And so you're like, well, maybe I can do these two, right? And so you can build a partnership that really focuses on what you bring to the table. And so your relationships may not be with the government directly. Your relationships are with the primes. And so you focus there and starting to build those conversations, but you've got to have some sort of value prop. I think many people start in that space and they say, all right, we need construction. Yeah, we can do construction. All right, well, I need a cloud migration. Yeah, we can do that too. Like, what? So you got to have like a capability, but there is some stuff to learn. It is doable. We actually have an incubator called Hutch that there's a very heavy mentor public sector and government where we will walk people through that process and to your process. So let's talk later. Happy to get you plugged into our program.
Right.
Also, quick shout out for the Lightship team. We run Lightship Bootcamp. It is totally free. In fact, we pay for breakfast, lunch, and dinner and hotel rooms for folks to come and learn these strategies for growth. So if you go to lightship.education to sign up for a bootcamp slot.
Mm. Love it.
Roger. One more thing, here at Champion, we at Champion 6 like to build stories and give things. At Brian's program, I gave him this particular coin. I want to give it to you, you know, because I want you to join the Champions family. So I want to give it to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Love it. Next question. You got a gift too?
The gift of my presence.
Amen. Amen.
Received.
I'm Chata Noir, and I'm the very recent founder of an arts equity organization called Okike. And I'm wondering what strategies for both of you have you seen be successful with linking up with other Black businesses to hold institutions accountable? Like, most of my clients are universities and nonprofits that make promises. Like, we're going to give $5 million to Black people, and then 5 years later, no one knows who got the money, what happened. So a lot of my individual clients who aren't the institutions are trying to follow up with those things. So what strategies have you seen or used to make sure that Black organizations can connect to, not fight, I don't know a nicer word, but make sure that those institutions keep their promises?
I'll go second.
I think there's two ways to think about that. I certainly think that there's, we have responsibility to keep people accountable. I think it's a little bit different when you look at the private sector, right? The private sector doesn't have to meet quotas. They don't have to do these things, right? A lot of times it may be driven by their board. It may be driven by an internal DEI office that they might have. And so something's popular when it's popular. Mm-hmm. And when it's not popular, they don't have to, right? And the way to pressure them often is stop buying their products. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're not supporting you, stop buying their products, right? And so, but many folks understand. But many folks don't have staying power, right? And so you might stop buying for a week, but they're like, they'll be back next month, right? Mm-hmm. And so they don't have incentive to change because you're not messing with their bottom line. And so I think a lot of times when you are working with from a private perspective is figure out, you've got to link to their business model, speak their language, right? If this comes off as this is charity that we need to do, when we don't feel like it or we got a tough year, then we will stop. Now, if you're telling me it's more profitable to support Black people and here's why and here's how it helps my business, now we're aligned. We're on the same side of the table. Mm-hmm. And we're talking the same language and I'm bringing strategies and I'm going to prove out why this is more profitable for you and better for me, right? And that's a win-win proposition. So I always tell people, like, go in there, get on the same side of the table, right? And you align your interests and it's much more likely that it has staying power.
I have two very specific quick answers. One, we've got to support Black media so that they can make sure they're holding people mm-hmm. accountable. So we recently announced a new media arm for Black Tech Week. We did amazing partnerships with multiple organizations, including NBC News, which you see downstairs, and CNBC and Apple. We're very, very thoughtful about the ones we're most excited about, with the Black Wall Street Times, Black-owned, Brand & Culture, Black owned, and rolling out magazine Black owned, to tell the stories of Black founders and to have full editorial control, even including of NBC and Inc. and Apple News, over the pages around Black founder stories. So we will hold them accountable. And I'd love to partner with you on that. Second thing, I think, is our head of design and creative director, Grant Collinsworth, is here. He talks a lot at boot camp about identifying brands that are really, really bought in to mission. So we all know that Nike stood beside Colin Kaepernick in the face of people burning their Nikes, and revenue went up, right? Mm-hmm. And so when they do that, it tells us, I'm gonna get a couple pair. You know, I'm gonna get a purple set of kicks. You know? And I'm sure you're proud to wear those shoes, right? And so brands that stand for us are brands that we should stand for.
Yeah, agreed, 100%.
There's exactly 30 seconds left. That's how good I am at this job.
You are good.
But what I missed was giving you an opportunity to say, how can we find you? How can we follow you? Oh, you need to be on the cover of Forbes. You know, you name it. Like, how do we make sure that we hold you up in all your greatness? And 3.0, whatever that means.
All right, I'm taking my directions. So you can find me on social media, DeLalid. So hit me up on Instagram. I'm there. Fearless, we're at fearless.tech. Again, my personal is DeLalid, DeLalid. And one thing I will say as far as how you can help in is really sharing where we're going. I'm not looking at the clock for a second.
It's your house.
We really started thinking about what our future is going to look like as an organization, right? As we become a much larger business, I'm starting to think about, you know, both national and international expansion. And so we've just launched an initiative called Fearless 3.0, which is really our third iteration of the organization. Talk about iterating. 1.0 being like startup-y years of the organization, 2.0 being, you know, we're just starting to get a leadership team and building some of the fundamentals, and 3.0 really becomes about doubling down on impact, the people, and how we scale as a business. And this idea that you must marry purpose and profitability, right? This idea of impact and growth and scale have to be connected. And so we're calling it our 100-10-1 plan, which means by 2030, we're going to improve 100 million lives across the planet. And we'll be in 10 countries and $1 billion in revenue. And so we're on our way to that. We're on our way there, and so we're always looking for partners. As we will be expanding Fearless, we'll probably be coming to a city near you at some point around the world. And so we're looking for amazing partners. We're looking for cities that really, again, think as we think, the sense of equity and how we build software, how we build solutions. And so we'd love to partner and engage and have more conversations around that.
Yeah, we all want to help. So thank you so much. Thanks to Team Fearless.
That was DeLalid Jarasa, a fearless leader building not just a business, but a blueprint for values-driven innovation. His story reminds us that legacy doesn't require venture capital. It requires vision, consistency, and the courage to lead with purpose. Be sure to subscribe to Road to Black Tech Week, leave a review, and share this episode with someone scaling their own mission. And we'll see you this summer in Cincinnati at Black Tech Week 2025, happening July 14th through the 16th. Visit blacktechweek.com for details. Until next time, build boldly, lead fearlessly, and keep showing up.